One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
So while there's love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Classic words from a classic song, of course, and maybe, just maybe, applicable to some of the texts by Lorna Mackey, who we're going to speak to in a few moments, whether you consider My Protector, My Dragon, Forget Me Not, Quinn's Christmas Wish, all sorts of other scenarios. A self-described small town girl with big world dreams. We're delighted to welcome to our Author of the Week feature, the wonderfully talented Lorna Mackey. How are you, Lorna?
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. A genuine delight. Now, Lorna, share with us, where in North America are you based at present?
I live in a small town called Didsbury, Alberta. So just kind of towards the western side of Canada.
Okay. Excellent. So western side. I'm just sort of getting this coordinated because we're also joined by our usual co-host for these Author of the Week packages from the joys of North Carolina. It's Jessica Burtis. How are you, Jessica?
Hello. I'm pretty well. How is everyone?
Very good. Just a few more days before you have a change of presidency, we think. So who knows what could happen.
Yeah.
Good line. And also making her debut on this particular feature, an ACE Level 2 undergraduate from the University of Lincoln, which you know well, Jessica, having actually spent a term over here. Well, almost a term, had it not been for COVID. We've got wonderful Rebecca Bond. How are you, Rebecca?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Good stuff. Now, Lorna, let's kick this thing off, basically, because the first thing that I came to when I pulled up your website details was, wow, these are some racy illustrations. Are you a romantic writer? Are you looking for love stories? I mean, I love the way you say it's all about family and animals, etc. Share with us your writing process.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, so whatever I do write romance. I tend to write a little bit more on the spicier side of things. I write contemporary. I write fantasy. I also write suspense and thriller. I have a couple erotic stories, which are short stories.
Yeah, we'll step away from that today. It's a family audience, Lorna, so just ease back on that one. But yeah, that's fine. I mean, your father was an avid fisherman, and you're certain that your mother was Mother Nature. Extraordinary.
Yeah, they were fabulous. So from the time that I could remember as a little one, we were camping. My dad had jobs where he used to build roads. And so we would find ourselves literally from the end of the school year. So in June, so all of July and all of August, we were never anywhere where there's really, like, we were out in a tent, pretty much living for 2 months. So we did lots of fishing. We had lots of adventures. And of course, yeah, animals are a big part of my life.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Jessica, over to your good self, because I'm sure you've done lots of research in terms of this and be keen and eager to throw in some questions to Lorna. Over to you, Jessica.
I thought it was so cute that you said that you have an animal incorporated into every book. I thought that was so sweet. How do you decide on which animal and how you decide where to put them in the story? Why do you do that? I was curious.
Well, I always say that my animals in my story will steal your heart. Hopefully my characters do as well, the main character, the hero, the heroine, but if they don't, the animals definitely will. And again, it just came along with my love for animals. So I've always had animals going along with my camping and outdoor experience. We had always encountered a lot of wildlife, grizzly bears, bears, wolves, foxes. So wolves are some of my favorites, of course. And then for me, when I'm writing my fantasy novels, my crutch is cookies and cream. Cookies and cream and Fudgios, which are cookies. And if I have Fudgios and cookies with the cream and milk, then I'm set to have the weirdest, bizarrest dreams possible. And I create these weird creatures that end up in my fantasy novels. So I created a hippo dog burrowing owl in my one novel, which is in my my first novel called My Dragon.
Yeah, I'm just getting my head around this whole notion of Fudgio's cookies and cream. I mean, Jessica, I know you do creative writing over there in Appalachian State University, but I mean, is that something you've tried? Has it been advised by your tutors? You know, if in doubt, get out the cookies and cream.
It has not yet, but maybe I'll try.
Oreo chocolate bars work well too. I don't know if you guys have those in the UK, but Oreo Arrow chocolate bars are also, yeah, wonderful.
Right. Okay. Well, I think we've got Oreos and we got Arrows. I mean, I'm going to actually ask, I'm sure, our designated expert on this, because she is at the University of Lincoln at present. Rebecca, I mean, when you're doing your English work, etc., or maybe actually go back to the assignment you just produced, the fantastic work for Histories of Journalism. Were you a cookies and cream person? Did that kind of float your boat in terms of, this is what's going to get my expression going?
I mean, I can't say I've ever related to that before, but definitely, yeah, definitely. And we do have those in the UK, so yeah, we enjoy those too.
Yeah, I can see it sort of opening up a whole new routine here, the sort of dietary habits of fantasy authors and so on. And you said a hippopotamus a hippopotamus crossed with an owl?
He was a hippo dog burrowing owl. So yes, he had the body of a hippo, he had the head of an owl, and his tail was, I have an Alaskan Malamute, so his tail was an Alaskan Malamute tail.
Yeah. See, this is probably one of the reasons why people in the United States of America are concerned about those folk north of the border, and they think, what?
I mean, what's happening in Canada?
I mean, yeah. I know, Jessica, you're a keen Harry Potter fan, but I don't think even J.K. Rowling actually went for hippo dog burrowing owls.
She was not that good. She could not have thought of it.
I have a good friend who is an artist, and she's a brilliant artist, and she drew him for me. So I actually have a picture of him. He's incredible.
It's outrageous. Jessica, carry on.
What do you think has been the favorite project that you've worked on? I know that sometimes asking authors what their favorite book is kind of like asking them to pick a favorite, like, child. But if you had to pick, what do you think was your favorite to work on?
Well, I really enjoyed working on the fantasy that I was just talking about that had. It was actually probably the first book that I ever wrote. So that one is kind of near and dear to my heart. But I also really enjoy my series that I wrote called Treasures of the Heart, which is Gold Fever, which is takes place in Dawson City, Yukon. So it's about gold rush and the crazy things that people will do for gold.
And just following through with respect to that, I mean, you know, in a sense, I'm sort of, the first impression that strikes me is obviously, and you should never judge a book by its cover, but looking at some of the sort of images that we've got with respect to gold fever, cast in stone, and of course the stiletto spurs, etc., does your husband pose for these shots? I mean, is it a case of you get your artist on the whole thing? What's it all about?
He's some inspiration for me. I don't think I could get him to pose for the cover, but he definitely is my inspiration.
Okay. Rebecca, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at Lorna's website, or if you've got any questions you'd like to put to Lorna from your perspective as an English and journalism student.
I did have a look, yes. You touched a bit on fantasy there. I wondered if that was a genre you were always attracted to. Is that something you enjoy reading, and that's reflected in your writing today?
I read all of them. I do love, of course, always the romance is the top genre for me, but fantasy, I'll write and I will read both. Fantasy, contemporary, science fiction, suspense, thriller. Nora Roberts is my favorite author. I like Lisa Jackson because she has a lot of that suspense thriller stuff happening there. And then, of course, my fantasy. So, yeah, J.K. Rowling is great. However, she doesn't have romance in her novels. So,
Do you have a favorite out of those at all?
Sorry?
Do you have a favorite out of all the genres you write?
I think it would be fantasy and paranormal.
Okay. I enjoy reading those too, so I definitely agree.
Thank fantasy and paranormal, you have a lot more freedom with those, that type of writing, I find.
Definitely.
I feel like there's a whole bunch of boundaries I have to fall into, and I can kind of let my mind write about hippo dog burrowing owls and stuff like that.
I sense a definite hippo dog burrowing owl theme coming through here, which is good, and that makes sense. I mean, ever considered a kind of a political thriller featuring a hippo dog burrowing owl? I mean, you know, what's been happening in Washington, surely it's crying out for that.
I could certainly write a story around that and add some fantasy in there.
There's a lovely line which you said in terms of obviously your website, Lorna, about you living for romance and absolutely believing that true love conquers all. Now, we're having an interesting time in the world. You may have heard of it. It's a pandemic. They've got a second new virus coming out of Brazil now. Yay! In terms of COVID variants. Yes, don't panic, Jessica. Just deal with it. I know you're closer to Brazil than we are, than Rebecca and myself are in the UK, but, you know, it'll happen. Do you think that, Laura, it's really vital that we maintain that kind of positivity, and actually the happy ending is crucial?
Of course. We have to have a happy ending. I mean, everything I do likes to focus around that. I have to be positive always, and that's just kind of who I am. I always try to be positive and upbeat. It's tough. This COVID stuff has hit us so hard every which way. So... writing romance helps with that. I like the happy stories. I like the happy endings. Always a happy ending for me. I do think we have to stay positive. We have to let people know and share our rays of sunshine if we can, wherever we can.
Well, we're doing a feature shortly after this, which we pre-recorded earlier, in which it was found that Londoners are apparently the loneliest people in the United Kingdom, but people in Plymouth are least likely to be lonely, even in a pandemic. Maybe it's something about Plymouth. I don't know, but there we are. I mean, in terms of obviously the way that technology actually works and how we're running this interview, obviously for Siren Radio as well, it's become kind of the new normal. Have there been any dividends or aspects which you thought, actually, this has really been quite interesting, this pandemic, and it's enabled me to focus?
Well, I find writing, I don't know about Rebecca or maybe you, Jessica, I find it's very isolating, always has been, even before the COVID hit. So we kind of isolate ourselves as authors and kind of hunker down and do our business of writing. And so in that way, it's been kind of a bonus, because I haven't noticed that much of a difference, because I'm still at home doing what I do. I write. So that's been a good thing for me that way.
Well, let's open that up. Rebecca, how has your sort of writing been in terms of this system? Is it a case of hunkering down? And forgive me, I've forgotten again where exactly you're based in the UK. I know it's the south somewhere, but I just can't remember.
I'm based in Norwich, yeah. I think the free time's been a blessing in disguise in a way. I mean, aside from assignments, it's been a nice time to sort of sit down and really sort of work on the projects that you haven't had a chance to maybe before, when you had all the other responsibilities. So it is nice to have the free time, and I definitely agree with Lorna there. You have a lot of time to focus on what you want to, and you're, as a writer, you're allowed to do what you enjoy and have the time just to, you know, isolate yourself to do that, which I think is really nice.
Jessica, what about yourself?
I actually quite agree with Rebecca. I think that, you know, having so much free time on our hands is a good time just to work on projects that you might have put off otherwise. I haven't had as much time recently because I've begun work on my thesis for my senior year, but...
And of course, there's your weekly radio commitments as well, of course. I mean, the media stuff as well.
But I think that, I think that the pandemic has provided people with, you know, no other alternatives but to kind of turn inward, because we can't go many places outside.
So, thesis is a big deal.
Sorry, Lorna, we just missed out that slightly. Could you just repeat?
I just said, congratulations, Jessica. Thesis is a big deal.
Thank you so much. It's not romance, sadly, but thank you.
Share with us, Jessica, what is your dissertation, final year thesis on?
It's quite morbid compared to our conversation about hippo owl dogs, but it's about death and Harry Potter. As a gothic coming of age.
That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah, and it fits perfectly. I mean, you know, basically, if you start seeing hippo burrowing owl dogs, then, you know, you're going to sort of think, well, something's going to happen. This is transcendence.
Cookies and milk.
Yeah. Lorna, would you say that there's a difference between a love story and a romance? I mean, this is something we've talked about with previous romantic writers and people who've actually been quite clear in the fact that they see the two things as totally different. And I think the working definition that we've had was that a love story ends in tragedy, a romance usually has a happy ending. Is that a kind of global statement, or do you sort of think, no, they all conflate together?
No, I think the romance leads to a happy love story. The romance is part of it. The romance leads to a never-ending love.
Which is, I mean, a very Canadian thing to say, actually, really. Maybe it's something to do with the plains and the rest of the sort of bits and pieces from that. And also, from an early age, apparently, you were always to be found with your nose buried in a romance novel. I mean, I would have thought the print might have stained the nose, but never mind, that's by the by. Was that a specific sort of genre you like? I mean, were you never tempted to go to hard-boiled detective fiction, to westerns, to biographies, to any of the genres that are actually out there? Or is it a case of, no, you prefer the romance?
Well, you know, in high school, reading all of our books that we had to read in, you know, high school, I was always in love with Wuthering Heights. So, again, that's like a sad love story, but I loved it. So I knew I really liked that. And then I also had a girlfriend who loved historical romances. And I never at that time had read, I'm sure, a historical, or not a historical, but a Harlequin romance. And she lent me one, and of course they were very little. And I could read through those books in a day. They were flying off the shelves for me. So I knew at that point in time I was hooked on romance. But back then I hadn't stumbled on, back when, my age, I hadn't stumbled on a whole bunch of fantasy or paranormal romances back then. And then once I did, then I really, my doors opened and I went, oh my, now I really know I'm meant to write this.
Yeah, owl dog burying owls, oh my, and so on, to, again, paraphrase L. Frank Baum. Rebecca, any other questions you got from your own, from your Norwich perspective?
From my Norwich perspective?
Exactly. Sorry. Have you got any other questions you'd like to put to Lorna?
I mean, I've got quite a broad one, if you're open to answering one like that. Would you say you have, like, an interesting writing quirk? I read somewhere that Virginia Woolf, for example, she'd write every morning for 2.5 hours and she had that designated time to do so. Would you say you have any kind of quirks like that, or a certain way of writing?
Well, I like to try to do some writing when I go camping, because again, that's an inspiration for me, and the trees and the birds and the animals and the sounds of creeks and rivers running are always an inspiration for me. When I also work a full-time job. So for me, when I'm working full-time, I have to get up by 5 a.m. and I have to write at that time, because otherwise it's really difficult to do. So it's either 5 a.m. when I'm working, or always on the weekends for sure.
Oh, that's really interesting. Would you say being outside is a big inspiration for your work then? Does that come out quite a lot in the themes that you write about?
100% it does. In all my books, besides An Animal or a Critter, you're going to find yourself in some type of adventure or forest or mountainside or something like that.
Amazing. That's so interesting.
Jessica, final thoughts from yourself.
I would just have to say, when it comes to, like, writing itself, I genuinely want to know for my own writing as well. I know that sometimes I'll read a book and the characters who are in a romance, I'll just think, like, oh my goodness, they shouldn't be together. They're not compatible. So how do you go about developing that emotional chemistry that makes characters, like, the readers say, oh, they belong together. Oh my goodness.
Well, the conflict is a big deal. In romance, of course, you got to have that conflict. We all know it's going to have a happily ever after, but you got to have that conflict dragging throughout the story a little bit to make you go, well, what is that character doing? Why are they doing that? So it makes you wonder. And it really is, I think, one of the keys to having a good story is to have that, especially in romance, is to have that conflict.
Main conflict, hippo owl dogs, and Oreo bars. We have it.
These are the takeaways, Jessica. These are the takeaways. So, worth throwing.
I'll have to try the cookies, and you have to try the milk and cream and chocolate bars. Yeah.
Apologies, Rebecca. When I gave you feedback, obviously, on your assignments yesterday via Zoom, I neglected to mention, obviously, the cookies and the milk and cream from that point of view. So, yeah.
Clearly you did. Yes, you did.
So you can add that to the system as you're making your debut today, which is wonderful stuff. Lorna, what does 2021 have in store for your good self? More writing in the outside, more production-based things, more interconnections with respect to fantasy or romance or erotica? Where will you be heading?
Oh, goodness. I do have another fantasy time travel type of novel that I am writing. That I hope will be out in April. So I'm excited about that. I believe it will be a series. So that's kind of exciting for me. And when I have time, I can write pretty fast. So I'm not sure exactly when book two will be out, but maybe one and two here this year, and then early in 2022, book three, probably.
Speed not necessarily a thing. I mean, you can't hurry genius, obviously, but roughly, if your average novel is 90,000 words, say 90 to 100,000 or thereabouts, or 120 possibly, how long would it take you to actually sort of produce that?
If I didn't have to work full time, when I don't have to work, I do have summers off because I have like that teacher schedule, but when I can write a book in probably 3 months if I'm writing daily.
This is good stuff. LornaMackie.ca, presumably the best place to come to find out further details. Are there any other social media you'd like to promote at this stage?
Oh, I love Facebook. I have an author page on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. So most of those popular platforms, Twitter, all of those are that's me.
Excellent. And it's Lorna, LawnaMackie, presumably.
That's right. Yeah.
.ca, which is not easy to do with California. Whenever I see .ca, I for some reason think you're based on the west coast of America. No, different line entirely. You see, this is the difference, as Jessica alluded to. It's all right. It's because we're sort of European. I say sort of because I haven't known what Britain is these days, but still, carry on. And England. Jessica, it's over to you to throw those last two questions to both our debut author today, Lorna Mackie, and indeed our debut new host and team member of the Midweek Drive Author of the Week, Rebecca Bond. So over to you, Jessica.
Yes, Lorna and Rebecca, have you both had a reasonably interesting Zoomer link with us today?
And thank you so much for having me as well. It's been really fun so far.
Excellent. Well, that's a yes for Rebecca. Lorna, I think, just giggled. I don't know.
I'll take that as a yes.
It's been great. I hope someday to visit the UK. I have not had that chance yet. So,
yeah, it's not going to happen in the next few months, it has to be said, Lorna. I can predict that fairly certainly. Unless you take your own life in your hand, or you decide to change career and become a Premiership footballer, in which case you can travel all over the place. So that's fine, you know. But we look forward to that. And the next question, Jessica, is?
Will you both be joining us again?
Definitely.
I definitely will, yes, thank you.
Yay! Lorna Mackie, ace writer. Rebecca Bond, ace undergraduate at the University of Lincoln, where she's reading English and journalism, and she's based in Norwich. Yay! And Jessica Burtis. Has it been good for you, Jessica?
It's been fantastic, as always.
Excellent. Well, our next one up, I think, is in a wee while when we'll be connecting with Austria, amongst other things. So we sort of move slightly eastwards there and talk about Reiki therapy in Austria and more. For the moment, though, Rebecca Bond, Lorna Mackie, and Jessica Burtis, huge thanks, take care, and speak again very soon.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks very much.
John Donne, I think, is frequently credited with the saying, no man is an island. Maybe we should update that for the 21st century to say no human is an island, because certainly being alone, feeling as though we're alone, is something which, especially in a pandemic, is something which I think most folk will actually experience at some time. As we actually head towards Blue Monday as well, traditionally one of the saddest times of the year, when we just can't see any future in all sorts of ways, a recent survey by Buzz Bingo has suggested that actually, as well as the coronavirus pandemic, there's also a loneliness pandemic sweeping the land. Now, to talk us through this, who better than an ace media medic, whether it's BBC Radio 5 Live, TalkSport, whether indeed it's his awesome classic text, Old Fashioned Remedies from Arsenic to Gin. Who else could better sort of address this loneliness pandemic than Rob Hicks? Dr. Hicks, how are you?
I'm very well, Alex. I think I'm going to have to get a carpenter in to widen the door after that introduction. Thank you.
Well, I must admit, I mean, if anybody's thinking about a remedy of for loneliness as being arsenic or gin, no, just don't go there. That's the key thing. Just step away from that. So let's clarify that at the start. But this particular survey it kind of reinforces what I think most of us have already been aware of, that actually, despite all the technology, despite all the rest of the things that are actually there, people do feel as though they're isolated.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the research from Buzz Bingo has found that, you know, one in two people are reporting feeling lonelier than they have ever done in the whole of their life. And, you know, as an average, it's 4 months since people have met friends in real life and 3.5 months since they've met family in real life. And for one in five, they've not met a friend in real life for, you know, somewhere between 7 and 12 months. And that's heartbreaking, really. I mean, you know, that and you can imagine the impact that has on a person's emotional health and well-being. And I think one of the things that, you know, people are missing is their communities. And I don't mean just the people they live with in the neighbourhood, but, you know, their sports club community, you know, their pub community, their cafe community, their bingo community, things that, you know, traditionally have supported people emotionally, have been almost taken for granted in a way. You know, I go down to football on Saturdays, for example, or I go down and meet my mates in the pub every Friday night, for example. I go to the bingo on a Tuesday afternoon, for example. Those things that people have just done and have benefited from because they've had the emotional support, they've had the social contact, and these things have been taken away. I remember when, you know, my nan was alive, she'd be go with her friends to the bingo club a couple of times a week, and it was really much the social centre. It was where they went to meet. They had a cup of tea, they had some food, they played bingo, obviously, and they had a chat. And, you know, it was a real... You know, it was her social activity. It supported them in ways that perhaps people just didn't realise. So I think, you know, we've got to look at ways of maintaining these communities, and we've got to look at ways of keeping connected. You know, so that we get through this period in history with the best mental health that we possibly can have.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's interesting, my day-to-day work with the students at the University of Lincoln, obviously, we're talking about their impact. And some students, particularly if they've been from overseas, have had to actually cope with a unique experience. And I was interested in terms of this particular research from Buzz Bingo, as we mentioned, that millennials in particular feel lonelier than any other generation. 74% say that they felt alone in the last year, which is, of course, 70% above the national average. Is that maybe because they're too locked into Facebook and various other factors, that maybe sometimes when that's also problematized, they have issues?
I think there was a figure that really caught my eye, to be honest, because, you know, I think traditionally when we talk about loneliness, you know, you ask somebody who feels lonely, we maybe jump too quickly to the older population. And, you know, the fact that, as you say, so many millennials said that they were feeling lonely and were really feeling it most, I think it's part of it might be if you're a person who's working, for example, and you live alone, but you've been furloughed or you're working from home, then you've lost your workplace community. And like you say, with the students, you've kind of lost your student community. I know my daughter, who's in primary school, when her school did a survey with them, you know, what do you miss most about school, it was obviously being in school with her friends. That's what she was really missing. And so I think it just highlights the importance of us staying in contact in whatever way works for us or for the individual. So, for example, you know, my mum has scheduled Zoom calls with her usual group of friends that she would normally go for a walk with and catch up with and go to a cafe for a cup of tea or coffee, whatever. So she has those now over Zoom. I still sing with my choir every couple of weeks, you know, online. Yes, we're not in the same room, but we still are maintaining that connection. So, you know, and there's the Buzz Buddy scheme from Buzz Bingo, which I think is a very valuable idea, where their general managers will regularly call vulnerable and older members to try and maintain that sense of community. Because in the same survey, one in five people said it made them realise the importance of community, and how community has made them feel or makes them feel less lonely. So, you know, things like keeping connected, you know, keeping a routine, moving more during the day, whether that's indoors or outdoors, and doing things that we enjoy and filling empty time periods, if we have empty time periods in the day, I think is really, really important in helping us get through this, and to overcome the sense of loneliness. So you might want to think about, you know, doing the what I call get around to tasks. We've all got them, haven't we? You know, the repairs and the admin and the cleaning that we know needs doing at home, but we just manage to put it off. Yeah. Or do those things that we've always fancied doing but never really had the opportunity. So it might be to learn a new skill, you know, painting, crafts, hobbies, that sort of thing. I think it's important to try and look at the positive out of the situation that we're in, so that when we look back on it, it isn't all doom and gloom. It's, oh, well, actually, I learned to play the guitar during lockdown. Yeah. You know, it's something like that.
Absolutely. Look at the bonuses and the dividends. I was going to actually ask you, Rob, about your work with the North Kingston Choir, but clearly, even with Zoom and slight time lag and delay, you're continuing to actually engage in that, which is wonderful. In terms of the actual sort of other sort of surprise factor of this particular survey, the location, I mean, I think London has always been noted insofar as it's a place that people could have felt very alone in at the best of times, really, let alone in a pandemic. But Plymouth seems to be doing remarkably well in terms of that's the place where people feel the least lonely. I mean, is it something about being close to the sea?
I don't know. I don't think there's an explanation for it. I mean, I do think that, you know, big cities, you know, and London has always been the one, hasn't it? There are people say, despite there being so many people, people do feel lonely. The Plymouth caught my eye, actually. And you know, it's almost worth, is it because they have a better sense of community? Is it because they're by the sea? I don't know. Maybe we should look at Plymouth and adopt some of their methods. But I think the, you know, whatever it is you do, I think it is possible to lift your spirits. It is possible to reduce your feelings of loneliness, and the bottom line is, if you do something for somebody else and help them, it helps them, but also you feel good yourself. Yeah. So it's a win-win scenario. So certainly, if people are interested about learning more about the bingo community, then buzzbingo.com has some useful information on that site. If you're looking for, you know, more tips about how to manage loneliness and how to help yourself get through loneliness, then, you know, the charity Mind on its website has some great information, as indeed does the NHS website as well. So I think that's the important thing, is to be positive. We will get through this. There's no doubt about it. We will do. And in the meantime, reach out to people in whatever way you find is the best for you.
You see, that is why Dr. Rob Hicks is a media doctor extraordinaire. He segued seamlessly across that base without even having to be prompted at all. It's wonderful. He got the contact details and everything else. I'd also give a plug for drrobhicks.co.uk, because it's an awesome website as well. So that's well worth accessing. But certainly in terms of Buzz Bingo, well worth working through that. And possibly gratitude lists as well, actually just being grateful for all the things that we do have. Because even though it might seem a little bit low, as you rightly said, Rob, I think there are times and indications that actually there are positives in this wonderful world of ours.
I agree. I couldn't have put it better myself.
Dr. Rob Hicks, media doctor extraordinaire. Many thanks indeed. Keep on keeping on and keep up the singing, Rob.
I'll do my best. Thank you.
Clearly, with the pandemic and with all of the other fun things that have been happening in the globe, maybe we've forgotten that actually one of the things we've been focusing on over previous years in January, of course, has been Veganuary, the way in which we can actually change our dietary habits for the better. And to actually talk us through how maybe we've actually been moving into a vegan lifestyle almost unconsciously and actually developing good eating habits in all sorts of ways, we're delighted to welcome, first of all, from Veganuary, the wonderful Tony Morelli. Nelly, how are you, Tony?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Of course, Tony, Head of Communications and Marketing at Veganuary, and you've been a veteran animal rights campaigner for nearly 30 years, so you certainly actually go back to the 20th century, let alone the 21st century.
Yes, I was vegan long before it became trendy.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're also joined today by the senior product developer at the Co-op, a fine soul who's also a keen baker and indeed chairman and co-creator of LGBTQ plus community baking group called Village Bakers. It's the wonderful Kevin Sargent. How are you, Kevin?
I'm not bad, thank you.
Excellent. Tony, one of the things that I know with colleagues who are vegans and they've worked through this and they said with their own children what kind of converted them to veganism as a lifestyle, etc., and a nutritional format, was they visited a slaughterhouse. And I'm thinking actually to a certain extent, this might be one of the reasons why, as you were indeed the daughter of a butcher in Northern Canada, is that something where actually you see other fellow carbon-based mammalian life forms being put through all sorts of torture and things, I'm not going to eat them. Is that one of the motivating factors, perhaps? It's harsh, but it's kind of, you know, it's impacted so much.
I mean, it certainly helped me make the connection, you know, between meat and the animals that came before. I think with, you know, a lot of people, they just buy their meat in the supermarket, shrink wrapped or, you know, breaded, and it doesn't look anything like the animals. Whereas in a butcher shop, you know, in the back room, it is still the animal. So then when I met those same animals alive, I could make that connection very clearly. And being an animal lover, as most kids are, I just thought, I don't want to do this. I don't want to eat this.
Yeah. And I mean, looking at certainly the whole notion of how there is a shift. I mean, you said yourself that actually there was a time where you could go back to Dr. Doolittle, basically, and a reluctant vegetarian and all the rest of the bits and pieces. It's kind of moved away from being almost a fad and eccentric diet and lifestyle choice to something which actually has got huge impact, not only from our own personal health aspects, but also for the planet as well.
Yeah. And that's really, you know, where we're seeing a huge drive amongst people to eat more plant-based, you know, in their day-to-day lives, because we know the environmental impact of animal agriculture is so big that most people recognize now that we all need to be cutting back. So that's really driving a lot of the new products that are coming out, you know, in the supermarkets, because they know that sustainability, we need to be pushing more plant-based into everyone's diet.
So are people consuming vegan-based foods without realizing it? Are they, in essence, sort of unable to tell the difference? Is it a case of we're just sort of thinking, no, I'm just sort of picking this up because it looks like sausages, so it should be sausage, basically.
Well, I think that the Co-op have done some great research on this that maybe Kevin can talk about.
Kevin, over to you. Excellent. Yeah. Just talk us through this.
Yeah, definitely. So so the Co-op has done loads of research around this. And actually, 54% of us this year have been just inspired to become vegan. And is kind of the number one reason around that is actually health. But what was really interesting is that 63% in that survey didn't actually realize that they were buying some vegan products and then just absolutely tried them and loved them. But we're working all the time to kind of to develop new vegan products and also convert a number of our ranges to be suitable for vegans.
Now, the Co-op's Ethical Consumerism 2020 report, which of course is what we're referring to today, has suggested that the vegan market has more than doubled in the last decade. It's gone from 1.8 billion, it's now worth around about £1.8 billion. I mean, that's a significant business approach. I mean, is that something else which is a driving factor, Kevin, from the point of view of the Co-op, which fundamentally is a business? I mean, it does lots of ethical stuff as well, but it is a business. Is that one of the reasons why you felt actually you can't ignore this market?
I think at the Co-op, we look at it that we would always want to do what our customers want us to do, and yeah, the demand for vegan food is there, and as a retailer, we're here to serve that need, and obviously as a business, what give back to the community as we do that.
Tony, if we can turn back to your good self again, in terms of folk who might be listening to this who are sort of saying, don't try and convert me to your vegan ways, it's not going to work, etc., or indeed they have members of the family and they want to share with us, what sort of steps would you take in terms of advising folk that actually the food is as tasty, it's as nutritious, it's as worthwhile, and as we've said, it's got all of these positive factors as well? What steps would you suggest, Tony?
I mean, I guess the first point is Veganuary is really there to help people who want to make this change and give them the resources to make it as easy as possible. So some of the things that we recommend people start with is swapping out the plant-based, you know, their meat-based products for the plant-based equivalents. So things that have the same, you can cook them the same way, you can use them the same way as you would your traditional meat products. And that way it's not a whole diet overhaul overnight. You can still have your bangers and mash, but you do it with plant milk and plant-based sausages. So it's familiar food to you. And then we also say, you know, give yourself a break. There's, you know, don't be too hard on yourself. Do it at a pace that's sustainable for you, because that's a change you're much more likely to stick with. And then try and remember the reasons why you're motivated to do it as well. You know, if it's for health and you start seeing health benefits, that's going to be a really great motivator. But if it's for the environment, you know, keep reminding yourself that every time you're choosing a plant-based meal, you are making a difference to the planet.
And Kevin, looking at the fact that the co-op itself has actually doubled its vegan own label range this January, is this something which you can see sort of enhancing? I mean, share with us your own journey in terms of actually becoming vegan, or has it been a case of, no, in the Sargent family, we've always been vegans?
So yeah, you're absolutely right. Co-op has been doing loads of work in terms of increasing our vegan range. So as you said, we've doubled our grow range in co-op. And have really focused on making sure that we've got those quick and convenient plant-based alternatives for customers. In terms of my journey, like Tony, my dad was a butcher as well. My vegan journey is that I've practiced vegan and done various periods like Veganuary and experimented with vegan. And it's something where I actively look to reduce the meat within my diet. I wouldn't say I'm 100% there and 100% vegan, but like everything in life, this is a bit of a journey, and it's starting with small steps and small swaps, which helps me to reduce my meat and dairy intake.
And Tony, returning to yourself, I mean, you've obviously got a PhD in animal behavior. You've argued for both passion and pragmatism in equal measure to ensure that animal advocacy is maintained. Is this very much a part of that whole strategy that, you know, we take those slow steps? And as you said, you know, 30 years, it's a droplet in cosmic time, but it is a case of making progress so that by the time we get maybe to the year 2050, actually the vegans community and the vegan diet, it's not something which we talk about because it simply is. It's just there. It's kind of, it's accepted as the natural way in which we get our nutrition.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, really, at the end of the day, whether it's everyone reducing their meat consumption, you know, substantially, or a smaller proportion of the population eliminating it entirely, it's the same benefit to the planet and to animals. You know, and for most people, starting off by cutting back on animal products is a lot easier than cutting it out entirely, because it takes time to learn new products, new ways of cooking, and break old habits. So that's, you know, really what Veganuary is there for, to let people just dip their toe in the water with us, with some support, and then take away any changes, you know, that they feel have really benefited them.
Excellent. And final points at this particular stage. Kevin, where would you recommend people should go to find out further information? Or is it just a case of just go to your local co-op and ask there? They'll tell you where to find out details.
Well, definitely. You can either pop into your local co-op or you can just head to co-op.co.uk, which has loads of information about our grow vegan range and also information to help support you.
And Tony, I would suggest, obviously, it's well worth accessing plantbasednews.org. But as far as Veganuary is concerned, is it simply a case of just use your search engine, type in Veganuary, and magic will ensue?
Exactly. It'll take you right to our website that has lots of resources. And then, of course, you can sign up at any time of the year. It doesn't have to be January. And you'll get 31 days of emails with lots of recipes and support.
Dr. Tony Bonelli and indeed Kevin Sargent, huge thanks indeed. And happy eating, people, from a vegan perspective. Many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here we are. The Midweek Drive continues. We've had Resonance Rewind. We've actually had that joyous time where Jean Bruce Scott was able to comment on the first season, well, the first episode of season three. And the similarities, of course, between the lead character there, the villain, and indeed the former President of the United States, although he still maintains he's the President of the United States. Let's not go there. Let's welcome the director extraordinaire, writer, actor, and man behind the Lady Killers, and of course, the joyous world of Shilpak Hollywood. It's Phil Leonis. How are you, Phil?
I'm good. I realize that you are 8 hours into the future. So maybe you know something I don't, but I think you were referring to the 45th president of the United States, and Alex, he still is president. He's good. President until January 20th, unless you know something that I don't, again.
That would be a peach of an argument, Phil, but let's not go there because that's a different line entirely. So, you know, you'd be working through other aspects. But it was intriguing, though, in terms of the facts of that. And I'm not sure how much of a fan of Airwolf you are, but in terms of the overall system, we had the villain played, of course, by the wondrous Richard Lynch. His name, of course, was John Bradford Horn. And John Bradford Horn seems remarkably similar to Donald's John Trump, basically, in terms of John Bradford Horn. Donald's John Trump. I just put that out there, you know, in terms of the sort of system.
Are you going to tell me that there's the same number of letters and everything? And it's, I don't know. Here's my knowledge of Airwolf. I certainly enjoyed the movie Blue Thunder.
Yeah, just as well you didn't join us for Resonance Rewind, because I would have had to have muted your microphone there and then, really. I mean, honestly.
I let it not be said that I do not do my homework. I, of course, am going to hold up a whole lot of sheets of paper and pretend that these are actual notes of questions I'd written down for Tara Bennett, who I find out is not feeling well. And so we hope.
But she will be with us next Wednesday, Phil. So she will return, and she's promised to be back, she'll be back then, because one of the things that I can actually hold up, which we would have been focusing on, which of course launches us on Disney Plus, is this little series, which she's written about 8 pages on. It's The Joys of WandaVision. WandaVision, the latest Disney Plus scenario with, of course, Elizabeth Olsen and Paul Bettany as Wanda the Scarlet Witch, and the Vision in the latest scenario of Fun Times that's actually there. So that's what they'll actually be involved with from that point of view.
I am very good friends with one of the chief writers on that show. And perhaps a connection could be made. I'm not sure she's, you know, writers are often somewhat shy, though this gal is outgoing and has a personality that can fill the entire transatlantic link. So perhaps that's an introduction that needs to be made.
You know, this is clearly something which you led the way with back in the days with Shilpak Hollywood in terms of the on-air production meetings that we've actually worked our way through that. So it just adds to the
something.
Joy.
We want to give people something to look forward to, especially in the wake if they're tuning in, hoping to hear Tara Bennett. And it's just a couple of cranky old guys who are very much like the critics on the Muppets who sit around.
I've told you before, if you're looking for Muppet characters, I would probably go more with either Ralph the piano player, possibly Sam the American Eagle, but not Statler and Waldorf. I'm afraid that Statler
you are
and Waldorf.
You're never cranky, even with even when Richard Fitzwilliams pushes your buttons, you're not cranky ever. But I will tell you this, since we are having a production meeting on the air, and this is, you know, people like seeing behind the scenes. Oh. I made a living for many years making behind the scenes documentaries. I know of what I speak. People want to know how the sausage gets made. So, Alex, next Wednesday, you won't see me. And quite honestly, I think I'd be surprised if Tara makes that appointment, because we have a little thing going on here in the U.S. next Wednesday at that time called the inauguration of a new president.
Ooh. Well, so there we are.
My responsibilities as an American patriot take precedence on that day over my responsibilities as an international,
of course,
broadcasting of course. Citizen of the world. Yes.
Jack Schaefer. Is it Jack Schaefer? She's one of the writers, I believe, on the series. Could it be Jack Schaefer?
Is this what we're going to do for the rest of the time? You're going to guess? No, I suddenly better make sure that she's credited. We can edit, right? You edit?
Of course, exactly. Yeah, that's all fine. Phil, we're hopefully looking to good news from the point of view of the Robin Pierce camp, insofar as I think we're trying to spread the word now that the Lady Killers is actually available online, or will be shortly available online to the global audience. As you said, when we did a feature on that, it's a movie that's kind of come of its time now, basically, and probably, I'd say, will resonate accordingly.
Yes, I think, you know, we made this in it. We made this film about misogyny, about exploitation, and wanting to kind of shine a light on so many of the tropes and the cliches in films and in storytelling that are driven by these rather dark energies. And certainly in the wake of Me Too and Time's Up, the film The Lady Killers ended up being one that went from being way too dark to being one that seemed to be addressing the time in which we're living. Also, I would say, though, that since then, since Time's Up, since Me Too, the social justice movement, Black Lives Matter, violence in our capital, all of these are things that relate to topics we explored, because what we were truly looking to investigate was the ways that exploitation in its many forms almost always leads to violence, it seems. And during Time's Up and Me Too, people were particularly paying attention to how The Lady Killers explores the concept of sexual violence. But let's face it, exploitation of people's fears and the incitement that seems to ensue thereafter certainly is present in The Lady Killers as well. And as dark and as heavy as all that sounds, it's a fun caper mystery of a film, isn't it, Alex?
It certainly has a range of things. I was just wondering, could it be co-executive producer Mary Livanos that is a colleague of yours on WandaVision?
I'm pleading the fifth at this point, but I will say that this woman was kind enough to give one of the first peer reviews of The Lady Killers back when we were first trying to figure out how to position it to distributors. So a little bit more self-promotion. Yes, the movie, The Lady Killers, is available, English language only, around the world on demand. People can find the link at theladykillersmovie.com. There's a lovely little box that says on demand outside the USA, and it's available to rent or to own.
Which is well worth accessing, and given that England and indeed Britain is pretty much in lockdown three conditions.
Are you muted?
No, I thought we're still live. Can you hear me? Have we lost the sort of system?
What do I do?
I've unmuted myself. Are we okay now? Can you hear me?
No.
Yes.
Yeah, no, we're okay.
Again, editing is going to be wonderfully sort of put to the fore in this particular number, which is all great.
You know what? It's fine. It's fine to just call this conversation a rehearsal.
Indeed so, because Chloe obviously is not joining us, and I'm still keeping an eye on this other meeting that's taking place, which is wonderful, because I can hold up the other computer, Phil, and see that in that sort of system, we've got a range of my other colleagues and characters at the University of Lincoln in a staff student forum, which I've kind of temporarily left, or at least I've gone silent on in this particular moment, to actually ensure that this is coming through. It's a crazy time. That's all I can say, a crazy time. But life continues.
I felt like you were holding up that box to me. I can't remember the name of the episode, sadly, but you were holding up that box to me that nobody was able to look at in Star Trek, except for the one lady who was blind, and she could see the beauty.
Is there in truth no beauty? I mean, this is the key thing.
Miranda
is blind. You know, she's genuinely, she couldn't see bones. She was really blind. Maybe too much. Anyway, so it goes. This thing you call language, how strange it is, and yet how little mastery we have over it. The good news is, Phil, that in a few weeks' time, we will be welcoming you back to Resonance Rewind, And we'll be focusing primarily on Return to Tomorrow, because that is our reason for being. That is our existence that will be actually there. And I think that's scheduled for a fortnight today, all being well. So more details to follow as far as that's concerned.
That's why we're aboard her? Risk is our... Okay. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So that's the one that's coming. Next week, you're more than welcome. Of course, it's Logan's Run, The Collectors. But as you said, rather than actually watching a classic episode of Gregory Harrison and Angela Cartwright and the late, great Heather Menzies and Donald Moffat as Rem in an episode there, you'll be watching the inauguration of a president of the United States. Frankly, I'm shocked. But never mind. Life continues. That's the sort of tease ahead. Phil, Chilpack Hollywood, that is continuing as ever. How are you finding those links? Have you switched to Zoom, or is it a case of, no, we still connect as we've normally done between Dean Haglund and myself and use traditional methods of communication?
We did an episode recently with the poet, Betsy Holloman Burke, and we utilized Zoom for that. And I do believe, actually, that we should be doing more episodes with guests and utilizing Zoom to do that. The reason that we hadn't, honestly, is that whenever Dean and I are in separate cities, as is most of the time now, I haven't found us interviewing a guest to be nearly as enjoyable when it was around a table, face to face. But we both found the Zoom experience for that particular show quite rewarding. So I think we're working on having some other guests that way. But for the most part, the heart and soul of the show every week is two guys communicating by telephone.
And if you haven't checked out Chilpack Hollywood, do that now. It's chilpackhollywood.com. You can find it on all sorts of strap lines. This has been the Phil Lynas promotional 10-minute slot in which he promotes his movie, his video. We've teased ahead to WandaVision, which may or may not be taking place next week. We may have to reschedule with Tara for another day entirely. And, of course, we've looked at Chilpack Hollywood. Phil, I'll throw those last two questions to you because it's almost like the standard line, slightly later than the old days, pre-COVID, etc. Have you had a recently interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
I have no way to describe what just took place.